Session number 22924, Reel 2.
Mr. Wright, okay. Reel 2.
I picked up two girls who I think were working in the census office or somewhere. They wanted a lift. And they said, "Have you heard that the Prince of Wales and the Renown have been sunk?" And I said, "No." And I thought, "My God, this really is the you know, the end of the battle as far as Hong Kong is concerned." And so I then went up to my flat, and I realised it was going to be, I think we still hoped, we'd stand out for a long time. And I went to my flat, rather like Desert Island Disc, what books would you pick if you were on a desert island? And I picked three books to take out to see me through siege, as we expected. And one were Churchill's speeches, which I'd got a volume of. One was a rather delightful poem by Richard Aldington. And one of the poems of G.K. Chesterton, it was an odd choice. Anyway, I picked these up from the flat and went back to the battery to find that during that afternoon, the Chinese were very demoralised, pretty demoralised, and there had been a flotilla of junks, because where we were south of the island, we overlooked that we were defending the Lama Channel and a possible landing from Lama Island. That was the purpose of the battery. And during that afternoon, a whole flotilla of junks began sailing from Lama Island towards Aberdeen. And though I wasn't there at the time, but this was reported to battle headquarters, and we were told immediately to fire on them and not allow them to access to Aberdeen. And so we did fire on them, and they quickly turned round and went back. According to the official history of Hong Kong, this was an attempted Japanese landing, and these drunks did in fact have Japanese troops on board. I don't know how the general knew this. But so far as our Chinese troops were concerned, they felt that it was Chinese fishermen who were, Hong Kong fishermen, who were trying to get back to the shelter of Hong Kong, Aberdeen Harbour. And that, you know, by firing on them like this, that we repel them. And anyway, but what explained, you know, why we had to fire, and they accepted this. And but it was really quite a difficult time that night. They were very, very upset, the Chinese.
How did they express their?
Well, we were all, we had strict military discipline, but we were all friends, and they were just able to, you know, to talk and say, you know, it was terrible, we shouldn't have done it, and but it was explained to them why it was done, and they could see the logic of it. After all, the purpose of the battery there was to stop a possible Japanese landing, and when it was explained to them, they accepted it.
Were any of them sunk?
I don't think so. I was not there. But, and again, this was not talked about very much by the officers. I think it was overtaken by the sinking of the two battleships, and so it was not a topic of great conversation. But no, I think that I think probably one or two were hit, but they quickly turned round and went back.
What happened next to you?
Well, the next thing, we just went on with this. Actually, the next minor excitement after the Japanese had landed on Hong Kong Island and had split the island in two, two or three of the batteries were changed from their normal role as batteries to infantry. And there was a possibility of this happening to us, and I was got instructions from, again, on my battery commander did, and I was given a job to go down to make sure that if we had to evacuate the battery and become infantry soldiers on Hong Kong Island, we could get sampans to take us across from, you know, from. And so I went back and checked that there were plenty of sampans, and that there were going to be no trouble about getting the battery over to Hong Kong Island. But fortunately, from our point of view, I think the powers that be decided that there was a greater danger of, or there was still a danger of, a Japanese landing from Lama Island. So they kept us there, and we didn't have to become infantry, whereas number one battery, volunteer battery, they were trained into infantry and they had about 80% casualties. You know, they just weren't trained as infantrymen, and it was terrible, the casualties they suffered out at Stanley. So we were very, very lucky. And other than that, we had the occasional shelling, the occasional bombing, but not serious, because I think that they were bombing. I think they just wanted to make their presence felt, the Japanese, as far as we were concerned. But they did quite a lot of bombing at Aberdeen itself, which had been, when the naval dockyard was evacuated from Hong Kong, from the harbour, they came over to Aberdeen. So there was a naval headquarters in Aberdeen, and that came in for a lot of bombing, and I suppose we got a bit of the aftermath of it. We had a very easy time in our battery.
And then?
Then on Christmas Day, you know, we got these messages from Churchill, one from Matthews from Churchill, about fighting to the end, and I must say that there was no question of any of our Chinese troops deserting. They could have slipped off quite easily, but they didn't. We ended up, and on Christmas Day, we noticed in the afternoon a lot of bombing of the peak, fires on the peak in the early afternoon, and then night came, and we noticed that cars were driving around on Hong Kong Island with headlights on. So we wondered what on earth was happening. And an officer, not me, another officer in one of the other ranks, went over to naval headquarters, which was been moved to Aberdeen, to ask what was happening. And we were told that we had surrendered at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And we had been cut off. All our telephone lines had been, so that by the shelling, had been cut. So we then spent that night, our drill was to blow up our guns. But we thought that if we blew up our guns, we might start another another small battle if the Japanese saw big bangs going. So we spent the night taking every shell down a rather precipitous path where about 100 foot, 150 feet up, the batteries were down to the sea and dumping them in the sea. And the breech mechanism and all the working parts of the guns we took out and dumped into the sea. And that really, we spent the whole night really doing that. And then the next morning, Boxing Day morning, we rather wondered what to do next. And my recollection here is a little bit vague. I think we had that whole day in the in our battery position. And so I went over to Aberdeen Naval Headquarters to see what was happening. They said they were they had instructions to go back to Hong Kong, to Murray Barracks. And so we thought, well, we'd better follow them. We decided we would go over to the industrial school, so we left our battery position and went by sampan across to Aberdeen itself. And there was quite an interesting little episode. I mentioned that one or two of us who had cars had used cars after mobilization to act as battery transport. And I travelled across in a sampan with one of our sergeants. And he had a very nice sports car. And we were going to the industrial school, which was 400 yards, 500 yards down the road. And Sergeant Patton said, well, we might as well drive down in my car. Mine had been shelled, mine was a write-off. And as he was getting into his car, somebody opened the door the other side. And Patton said, hey, this is my car. And the Japanese officer, in perfect English, said, I'm very sorry, Sergeant, but it's my car now. He said, I can give you a note to say that I've requisitioned it. And he said, and he delved in his pocket and he said, I can give you a bar of chocolate. And he pulled out what used to be a Fortney bar of Cadbury's chocolate, which they had probably. And, the usual, he could so easily picked up his revolver and shot us both. But it does show not all Japanese were bad. And so Patton and I walked down to the industrial school. And I think we were there for a couple of nights, where we kitted ourselves out. because the store, we didn't loot the store, the store was open, and we kitted ourselves out. We knew we were going to be prisoners, and I know I took a very, very nice naval blanket and some naval, thick naval navy blue stockings, and we also fed very well because they had a lot of food there. And then I think on the 29th, while we were there, Japanese came in and checked up. We handed in all our rifles and so on, we dumped in the sea. So they checked we hadn't got any arms with us, and they're very civil, and left us there. Then we got instructions on the 29th to march into Hong Kong, Hong Kong to Murray Barracks, which was the rendezvous for all the POWs that could get there. And we marched in with a complete battery. I'd say there'd be no desertions. And arrived at Murray Barracks very late in the afternoon, spent the night there. And the next day we had this, the whole garrison marched off to prison camp at Chemchepel.
What was that like?
It was a bit of a mess to start with because it had been built as barracks in about 10 years, I think, before the when the first Japanese scare started, when they attacked Shanghai, and the garrison was increased, but it had been badly looted in the time of after we had departed from or evacuated Kowloon. There was a great deal of looting went on, and then all the windows had gone and all the doors had gone, so we really went into empty shells of huts. And I think the first couple of days was pretty chaotic. Nobody quite knew what was happening, but you know, the army could be pretty efficient on these occasions, and they sorted out the troops were put in, huts were allocated to various group batteries, companies and so on, and the officers, there were some flats which had been occupied by NCOs, I think, when it was operated as a barracks, and the officers were put in there. No beds or anything like that, you know, it was all very, very, very basic. And but within two or three days, it was pretty well organized. And there was quite a lot with our own troops. It was quite interesting because they only had to. There was wire around the camp, but not really effective barbed wire or anything like that. And I know one or two of my my gunners came to me and said, you know, what should we do? And I said, well, it's up to you that you can stay here. And we still kidded ourselves it would only be 3 or 4 months before we were relieved, because the rumours going round that the war was going very well in Singapore, in Malaya, that the Japanese were being thrown out of Malaya. So we were, you know, fairly confident that 3 months would be the end of the war in the Far East, or to us, we were concerned. We'd be relieved, and I said, well, you know, you'll go back and join your families, or if you stay here, while you're in here, you'll be getting paid as your soldiers. At the end of the war, you'll be getting getting your back pay, but it's up to you. You certainly won't be looked upon as deserters if you. And about half of them, they just had to take off their uniforms and go up in their singlets and underpants, which was quite a normal way for Chinese to wander around in those days, coolie Chinese. And some decided to stick it out in the prison camp, some decided to stay with their families. But this was all done, again, with our permission, that they consulted the officers before doing that.
How were you in much contact with Japanese guards?
No, they were very disorganized, so disorganized that God, there were hawkers all around, and you could buy cigarettes over, if you had any money, Hong Kong money, you could buy cigarettes over the wire, or a bottle of whiskey over the wire, or even you know, tin cans and plates and things like that to make life a bit more comfortable in the in the camp. And and I suppose this lasted for a week or 10 days. I wouldn't like to be specific about the time. But it took the Japanese a bit, you know, they suddenly found, well, I'm 8,000-10,000 troops suddenly in this old broken down barrack area, and so they had to do their organisation as well, and I think they did it pretty well. It must have been a week actually before they got proper wire round and proper guards round and things like that, but as far as the Europeans are concerned, it was very difficult, unless they had made prior arrangements to escape, because if you were out with a white face, you were quite clearly, you were 99% certain to be an escaped POW, so it was not easy to escape for Europeans, even if there was very little security.
Did you do any trading with the hawkers?
Yes, I think I bought, I used to smoke in those days, and I bought some cigarettes. That one, very useful, because we as colonial troops were not issued with winter uniform. We went to war in light khaki drill, and Hong Kong has quite a winter. I mean, we don't get frost there, but it drops down until the middle 40s with a very, very cold east wind. And it was very cold in those first few days in the prison camp. And the Royal Scots were completely, Murray Barracks was their home base, and they were completely re-equipped with new, brand new battle dress after the Battle of Hong Kong. And I suppose after the first week, most of the volunteers had brand new battle dress. Most of the Royal Scots, other ranks, were in khaki drill. And I got a full set of winter battle dress for 20 cigarettes. And I had no compunction in doing the swap. I was a man with a big enough bloody fool to want to flog his battle dress. I was going to... and this is it. This is actually almost all the volunteers did the same thing. They kitted themselves out, and this was, of course, a great help during the succeeding winters.
What was your general state of health as a captive?
I was lucky. I was the right age and the right build. I was in my late 20s. My normal weight was probably 11 and a half, 12 stone, that sort of weight. And if you were 6'4" and weighed 15 stone, or if you were 19 years old and still developing physically, then they suffered a lot. But if you were in your middle, late, between 25 and 35 and not too big, I mean, yes, you lost weight and the diet was pretty basic, but it wasn't, it didn't have the same effect on health that the big men and the young men.
What was your height at that time?
I think it's about 5'9". And also, we in the officers' camp, I don't think we had all that better food, but we didn't have to work. And where the other ranks suffered so much was that they had to go out on working parties, and the diet they got was not really enough to keep you going if you're doing physical work.
What food typically would you get?
Rice and rice and rice. And vegetables, usually chrysanthemum leaves. Quite often, sometimes we get spring onions. Sometimes some odd sort of root vegetable, rather like parsnips, but they weren't parsnips. I think they're called daikons or Japanese. We got no virtually no meat or fish, no protein. It was all vegetables, and I suppose the main thing was the chrysanthemum leaves.
What do they taste like?
like the smell of chrysanthemums, and it tasted like felt like spinach, and it was. But what we could do, there were two things that eased our. We were particularly in the volunteers. The Japanese did allow parcels to come in if you had friends who were not interned, i.e., if they were Chinese, Eurasian, Portuguese. They were allowed to bring parcels, and so most of the volunteers were in a position where they were getting their diet supplemented by parcels being brought in.
And that applied to you?
Yes, I had. I shared it with four other people. Five of us shared a parcel, and we were able to send out money. We were paid according to our rank by the Japanese. I, as a second lieutenant, I think my pay was about 50 yen a month. But they also charged 50 yen a month board and lodging. So I got no pay from the Japanese. But the general, our senior officer, worked out a sort of an income tax system. And colonels and generals and majors, they all had to put part of their pay into a common pool. And this was, when we went to a separate officer's camp, was meant that each officer and each batman got about 50 yen a month, which was enough to buy canteen. You say you could buy toilet paper and you could buy razor blades and things of that sort. And also, when the parcels got really organized, in my syndicate with the parcel, we had a couple of majors and a couple of captains, so able to send out quite a decent amount in military yen. It didn't go towards the full cost of the parcels, but it did help, and certainly the this would supplement the diet. It was mainly vegetables we got sent in, occasional tin of bully beef or something like that.
Where was this officer's camp?
It was in Argyle Street in Kowloon. It was a camp which, oddly enough, was built in 1937 to house the Chinese soldiers who crossed the border when the Japanese came down to Canton, as I said earlier on, came down to the border. A large number of Chinese soldiers, well, they deserted or not, I wouldn't know. Anyway, they came into Hong Kong territory. And we were at peace with Japan at that time, and so all these nationalist soldiers had to be put into an internment camp, and this internment camp in Argyle Street was put up very, very quickly to house these nationalist Chinese soldiers. And of course, when the Japanese war broke, when the Japanese attacked Hong Kong, they were all set free, and the camp was empty. And with a certain amount, perhaps, of tongue in their cheek, the Japanese put the officers in to take the place of the Chinese troops. But it was a self-contained, small camp.
Was it better being there than in Sham Shui Po?
Yes and no. I think we three officers in 3rd Battery felt very responsible for our troops. And we used to go and see them every day, although they were maybe somewhere away, and we were all within the camp, but we used to keep in touch with them. And we felt responsible for them, and it meant when we left Sham Shui Po, they were left to their own devices. Mind you, we had sergeant major and sergeants and so on, so they were not left, but they were left without officers, and I think we didn't really like that. But I think being in a smaller camp was psychologically pleasanter than being in a great big camp with so many other people, yes.
How long had you been in Sham Shui Po before you went to Argyle Street?
I think it was about 3 months. I think it was April that year. I think one of the reasons why there were a few escapes. Not many, but there are a few escapes. People managed to get through a drain and down into the harbour, and then swam across the harbour to the mainland and managed to get away. And I think it was after that the Japanese decided that the officers should be segregated. And it was April. I have to think of the dates now.
42
it would be, wouldn't it, when we were after 3 months to Argyle Street. And again, we started, having got fairly comfortable in Sham Shui Po and found a bed and things like that, we were back again, on the floor, having to make the best we could. But after a time, the Japanese brought in lots of additional beds, and so we did get off the floor. And I have got one or two sketches, actually, of the prison camp, our house at that time.
Did you or any of your friends attempt to escape?
No. I know it's the duty of every officer to try to escape, I think it's also the duty of every officer to look after his troops. And we genuinely thought of ours, we were going to learn in third battery. We had the local boys, as we call them, in our gun detachments, and we felt that no question of trying to escape, because our duty was to them. After the first 2 or 3 months, it was virtually impossible to escape, because the Japanese were very cunning, that they made us each nominate our two best friends in the camp. So if I escaped, my two best friends would be held responsible for my escape. And also that, though this was a bit later on in the prison camp period, there had to be somebody on duty in each hut during each night, through the whole night, really, again, as a hostage. If anybody escaped from that hut, the officer who had been on duty that night, or the officers who had been on duty that night, would be held responsible. So there was a case of one man, he was a volunteer, in 1944, decided he was going to escape. He notified the Colonel White, the senior British officer, who ordered him not to. He pointed out that by that time, we already landed in France. The war in Europe was clearly coming to an end. And he pointed out to this guy that if he went, his two best friends and the people who were on duty in the hut would almost certainly be shot. And that it was all for nothing, because by the time he was made fit, he would be the war would almost certainly be over. So the man luckily didn't escape, but the Japanese really put a kibosh any further escapes, I think, with this system. Again, we were criticised. Some of the I think one or two people still felt that we should have tried to escape in spite of any repercussions from the Japanese, but I'm afraid I don't agree with that argument.
What was your own relationship with the guards?
Well, I think one ignored them as much. We ignored them as much as possible. We had to recognize them. This caused a bit of trouble in the early days, because they said that we had to salute every time we saw guard that we should salute, and it was pointed out that they couldn't expect officers to salute other ranks. So there was a sort of compromise that we could give a little Japanese bow, or we could salute. If we hadn't got a cap on, we could give but mainly it was a case we had to acknowledge them in some way. Well, again, there were some people who wouldn't do it on principle, and of course they got beaten up, and then of course they had to they ended up by facing up to reality. And And so one trying to keep out of the way with the sentries, but one did occasionally get involved with them. Again, quite a nice little story in a way, that I had a great friend who was ill, very ill, mainly malnutrition, and he had a girl sovereign which he was keeping. Well, he got to the stage when he wanted to sell the girl sovereign, and there was a lot of trading with the sentries in the way of fountain pens, gold cufflinks, watches, and you could sell these things to the sentries, and again they would bring in dried beans or dried fish or things of that, so you could buy there was quite a lot of trading went on, or cigarettes, of course. I gave up. I was not hooked on cigarettes, so I couldn't buy cigarettes over the wire. I stopped smoking. But anyway, this friend of mine said, could I? So there was a going rate for gold, and when I was on duty outside on this duty hut thing, sentry came round, and so I approached him and, do you want to buy a sovereign? And he offered the going rate, and one trusted them, and he took the sovereign, and next time he was on duty, he gave me, I don't know what it was, several hundred or thousand military yen, which I gave to this guy who was in hospital. And then the next time round, the sentry, I'm sure he didn't come to my bed during in the middle of the night, and said, had I got anything else to sell? And I said, no, I was not one of the traders. I was just selling for a friend of mine who was sick. Well, did I make a good commission? I said, I didn't make any commission. I said, this was my friend. You have no commission? I said, no. A few days later, he was on duty, and he gave me a little bottle of sake. And I used to play bridge once a week, rather high-powered bridge with a colonel and a major. And I thought, well, you know, about next time we play bridge, we'd all have a little bit of this drink. Well, it was very cold, and to pull the mosquito down, it was a lovely feeling when you're in bed with the mosquito net down. You felt the only time you could really feel private. And so I'm afraid I had a little nip of this sake, and I'm afraid I didn't offer it to my bridge-playing friends for the next week each night. I had that.